The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. My guest is Andres Sandate. He is Managing Director of Cygnus Capital Real Estate Advisors, which invests in non-performing and defaulted commercial real estate loans, as well as other hybrid real estate investments and asset-backed loans, debt instruments, judgments, and tax deeds. Andre, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike. We're glad to be here.
Well, you know, debt is a big issue these days, and it takes on a lot of different forms. Let's start with that. What are some of the various roles that you see debt playing in the current real estate market?
I think the biggest role that it's playing now is it's filling a void that's been left post-Great Financial Crisis, or GFC, by the banks who've stepped back. By some estimates, you know, we see that banks' market share of the debt market is down close to 20%. A fourth of all community banks closed after the financial crisis. You know, the data that we track, the CMBS market shrunk by almost 20% from about $147 billion, expected to shrink to $54 billion. And just generally tighter lending standards overall since the Great Financial Crisis, which has created a tremendous funding gap or credit gap, which, you know, depending on which data sources you look at, is, you know, between $1.5 and $3 trillion. So there's just a tremendous amount of need for new sources of financing and credit in order to keep this real estate engine churning through.
We met each other at the ADESA conference and got in a conversation, and what your organization is doing was of interest to me. Talk a little bit about how your organization is using debt to increase real estate values and produce income.
Sure. Well, traditionally, real estate debt funds or real estate debt providers have been more focused on the origination side of this business or this opportunity. Cygnus Capital got started after the financial crisis in 2010, and we, like many real estate sponsors, you know, were able to take advantage and be pretty opportunistic in buying assets that were in distress. And out of that expertise, we launched a series of private fund vehicles and invested in a number of different food groups, multifamily, industrial, land, lots, etc. And over the 4 or 5 years that ensued from the inception of our organization, we developed a real expertise in doing really complex workouts and unlocking value from distressed and defaulted and non-performing paper. And I'd say that our core expertise that we've developed over time is just that. It's unlocking transactional value because of the inefficiencies between defaulted non-performing paper holders and the large buyer pool of quote-unquote clean assets. And I'd say to summarize that, in our experience, you know, we see a tremendously bigger buyer pool of performing deals that are clean, that don't have the quote-unquote hair on them, than we do groups that are interested in working through foreclosures and complex, you know, legal issues and going through a judicial or non-judicial workout. So that's really our sweet spot, and we tend to buy paper and participate, I'd say, in what most folks call the lower middle market or the middle market, and so there's just a lot fewer institutionally quality, institutionally sound sponsors that are able to participate and really actively want to participate in that end of the market.
Now, debt, you're interested in debt that's not performing, but debt that's not performing is non-performing for a reason. Does that not intimidate you? How do you really discriminate between non-performing debt that is just playing a loser and you don't want to touch versus that which is a true opportunity?
Sure. Certainly, you know, you have to purchase correctly. I mean, that, there's no getting around that. And I think, you know, we try to keep things pretty simple at our organization. And, you know, we use a sort of tenet that when we can purchase correctly, we think that there really is an opportunity. So I think, first and foremost, you have to have a view to the underlying collateral, because more than likely, in most scenarios, you're going to end up with the real estate. You're going to take the keys, as they say, and end up having to come up with a plan. And, where we've tried to unlock the majority of the value in our prior investments is really doing more of the cleanup process. And so we're pretty confident that by doing a cleanup process to the documents, to the paper, and that could be everything from, doing appraisals and bringing financial records current, working out potential, legal issues or lawsuits between parties, just going through and doing that workout process over typically a 12 to 18 month, up to a 24 month process, we have found that by doing that cleanup work and not getting too deep into the actual physical real estate and trying to execute a value add plan and trying to get that asset stabilized as a core plus asset, that there's a tremendous amount of interest from typically local operators for those deals. And so, we always are in a first position when we buy these deals, and then we're careful not to, compound what are already troubled situations by overextending ourselves in terms of, injecting, additional or unnecessary capital. And many of the assets that we do acquire, we're just simply not able to get financing on, although if we stabilize them, certainly in the past we have gone out and got credit facilities. But we buy all cash, and we typically try to close quickly and efficiently and be nimble and be in and out of assets, between 12 and 24 months.
Now, when I spoke with you at the conference, you were clear about the fact that you guys aren't doing value-add investing. You're taking possession of bad debt. You're taking possession of a property, and you are doing what with it? What kind of state are you trying to get that property into, and who is going to be an interested buyer within that 12 to 24-month time window?
Sure. So I would characterize our firm as a diversified real estate investor in that, we're very comfortable buying across different property types and asset types, and we're also comfortable buying a variety of different deal types. So we've done a lot of different types of transactions in a variety of geographies. So we're pretty agnostic in that respect. I'd say the one thing that we do tend to do is buy smaller transactions, just given the size of our organization. I think the main focus is in looking for the opportunity to come in, and where we really try to think about our value add is in that cleanup process. And so in the acquisition, what our asset managers and portfolio managers are doing is trying to underwrite and close and then quickly go through a process with attorneys, local counsel typically, where the assets are located, or working with attorneys who have been involved in that asset as it's gone through the court system, for example. And then what we try to do is really get our hands dirty and roll up our sleeves. And I know it sounds sort of, like an overused analogy, but by showing a willingness to get in and work out and restructure the paper and or a high degree of confidence in taking over the asset and running it, and just doing that cleanup process, which sometimes takes, what we found is it takes different forms. Sometimes it's an environmental issue that needs to be remediated. Sometimes it's just a messy situation between a borrower and a lender, and they're no longer talking, and they just need a kind of an independent third party to sort of step in and mediate. And we've done that plenty of times. Sometimes it's a there's a dispute between a tenant and the borrower, so there no deals are ever the same. But generally, what we found is by coming in and sort of taking a much more objective view towards it, and then really the exit for us, we found what tends to work the best is when we leave enough meat on the bone, if you will, for a local operator typically, and sometimes it's a fund that's just specializing in a specific asset type or a sub property type. in Iowa or in Ohio, for example, that is very comfortable buying an asset that has the potential to be a value add play for their fund and for their investors. But if we try to drive that asset all the way through to high occupancy and really dramatically change the economics and create substantial increase in rent, et cetera, then it doesn't leave much for the next group. And where we think we can generate, attractive kind of low double-digit returns for our investors, which we think in this environment is attractive, there's still plenty left to do for the next group. And that's where, we've been able to find some success.
So everybody's really expecting there's going to be a real estate correction sometime in the near future here. So is your feeling that there's equally good opportunities for this type of debt investing during booms and busts? I mean, if once a correction happens, which, is inevitable, is that an even better market for you? Is it any better during downtimes than it is during good times? Like, I think right now most people would consider the real estate market quite good. What about that?
Sure, absolutely. It's a great question, Mike. Optimistically, we want to be in a position where we've got, cash to put to work in a scenario in which we do have a reset or a pullback. We do agree that that's going to happen. It's inevitable. It's just that, everybody talks at real estate events and conferences. I was just in the Midwest this week at a big real estate event, and folks are talking about this could be a doubleheader, not the seventh or eighth inning. So we'll see. We're not here to try to call the market, but one thing that we do know is that existing investments in our current portfolio are well secured, and we typically don't hold any debt on them. So, first we like to talk to folks about what we currently own, and we feel really good about how we're positioned in the portfolio today. And then where we, hold performing debt, we'd be happy to foreclose and hold the asset if necessary. And then when you think about the opportunity set that comes, we certainly would expect that we're going to see just more volume in the scenario where we have some type of a pullback. And that, I think that bodes well for what we do as folks have gotten to know organization and our strategies and kind of what we do best. Certainly, we think that more bad mortgages, more distress is only going to play well, if you will, for what we do. And the impact on us if that plays out is, at the end of the day, you just want to be in a position where you have capital to put to work. One of the things about the distressed opportunistic space is that typically it's been a space where, emerging real estate managers, there's few of them participating. It's generally been a strategy associated with more large traditional real estate sponsors, a lot of well-known names and, very successful brands. And so that's another factor I think that distinguishes us as an organization is that, this isn't our first rodeo. We've been doing this now for, 7-8 years. And, we came out of the great financial crisis. And, we're gaining a lot of momentum, having a lot of good conversations with folks. And we're pretty optimistic about the opportunity set. We see tons of distressed opportunities now, given the deals and where we focus. That's not the case with all investors, and certainly when that cycle resets, I think that we'll be able to have constructive conversations with folks that own assets, and also with investors who are looking to be opportunistic and work with a real estate emerging manager of our size.
Where are you finding distressed opportunities now? Are you knocking on the doors of banks? Do you have relationships with banks that turn to you and say, "Look, we've got a dog here. We need to get off our hands. Are you interested?"
You, we're used to see that more, Mike. Now, more and more, what we see and hear banks doing is when they, you know, when they start to see an asset that goes into a troubled, non-performing, special asset situation, typically it's quickly kicked over to, you know, to a broker, and that broker is typically, due to new regulations and compliance, they're typically running an auction process. So, you know, so we participate, like everybody in the real estate business, in auctions. We do obviously always spend time out in the market originating, you know, building relationships from an origination standpoint, and our team is it's pretty opportunistic as well, in that geographically, you know, we like to think about this, you know, this distressed opportunity strategy is kind of what I to use a football analogy, it's broken field running, meaning, you know, sometimes the play breaks down and you have to be willing to move in a different direction and rather quickly. And so, for example, we've been opportunistically looking at distressed opportunities in Europe. And, you know, we think that there's just a massive deleveraging that's going to continue to occur over in Europe. And we've very tactically put some money to work in Spain in a for-sale multifamily product. I'm, in fact, going over to Spain this weekend with one of our partners to look at real estate assets and deals. And there's a tremendous amount of opportunity there. And in other, you know, other parts of Europe. And so for a firm like ours, you know, we are going to be opportunistic and be nimble, and we're going to look to find deals and look to find assets like everybody else, because of our mandate in a variety of different places. But you know, we see it off of auctions, and we track a lot of the same sources that the next guy is. And you know, we certainly we don't win very many deals. We look at a lot. That's one thing about our sort of investment approach, is that we're sort of willing to look at everything. You know, every once in a while, things line up and we're able to, you know, to buy an asset.
So out of 100 opportunities, how many would you actually act on, or
one?
Just one,
one or two. I mean,
one or two. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, our typical weekly pipeline of just stuff here in the U.S. For example, we're seeing a lot of maturity defaults, and these are loans that were underwritten, you know, with a 10-year IO back in 06, 07. They're in special, you know, they might have been within a CMBS tranche. And, you know, in those scenarios, they kick the can kind of down the road as far as they can go. The, you know, the person in the assets upside down, they were underwritten with pretty lofty assumptions, and they're just over-levered. And so we're seeing a lot of that type of product. And then, you know, I'd say in a typical week in our pipeline, there's $200 to $300 million worth of "quote unquote" product in the pipeline, and you know, we'll work on a number of those deals, and you know, maybe make offers on a handful, and then ultimately, yeah, it does feel like it kind of ends up being sort of a 1 in 100 type of situation.
So you get an asset, you need to manage it for a while, let's say, because you do hold on to these for 12 to 24 months. So obviously there needs to be management of the property. Do you turn to a property management firm and pay them to do that, or do you use in-house people? How is that part of it handled?
Well, we believe in, you know, really rolling up our sleeves and doing a lot of this work internally and being principals in our transactions and in all of our investments. And so we actually don't outsource much of the work. You know, we aggressively manage the assets using internal people, and you know, we think that saves not only costs for our investors and in our funds, but it also, you know, in everything that we do, we have an owner-operator mindset, and that's all about saving money and trying to increase value and enhancing returns. And so, yeah, that stabilization and trying to cash flow that asset, what we found over time is that, you know, nobody's going to care as much about that asset as we do. And so we've invested in the personnel and the infrastructure and the operational wherewithal and capacity in order to do the workouts internally. Now, we do rely upon local groups, whether to, you know, help us broker assets when they're ready to sell, or in some cases, we can't get around around the fact that we need to get local councils involved. And so, you know, we really rely upon local council in many cases who know these deals and have been working on these deals. But yeah, we've tried to use in-house sales teams, and we have a captive construction group that does assist us in even, you know, in construction, but, you know, all the loan workout, all the loan servicing, all the asset management, of course, all the property level accounting. A lot of that work has been done historically internally at our shop, and we found that that's yielded good outcomes for our investors. So over time, as the firm scales, you know, one of the things you have to think about is how do you continue to deliver if the business grows, and that's something that, you know, we think about a lot as an organization every day. But so far, we've really tried to build that workout capability in-house, and we've gained a lot of expertise as a result of doing it internally.
You mentioned that you're interested in European markets, but your material says that your firm primarily invests here in the United States. So let's talk about the U.S. in terms of which markets you will invest in. Do you stick with Tier 1 markets, or do you also go to secondary or even tertiary markets? And are there any cities in the country that you find an especially rich source, or that you're especially comfortable with?
Sure. Well, we started our firm in 2010, and we started in our backyard and bought a lot of multifamily assets around the Southeast, particularly in the Atlanta metro area.
Which is where you're based.
Harvested a number of those.
That's something I didn't mention.
Which is where we're based.
You're based in Atlanta.
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
We are based in Atlanta. Sure. So we are based in Atlanta. So, you know, logically, it made sense when we first launched the firm to look in our backyard. And so the first purchases were multifamily, and we bought a lot of assets in our backyard. From there, we sort of began to branch out and began to purchase assets kind of in the Southeast more broadly, kind of up the East Coast. And we've now, since inception, we've acquired assets in 20 states, and we've completed foreclosures in, I believe it's 13 or 14 states, both in judicial and non-judicial states. And that's really, really important because it's given us the comfort, if you will, to go and look at different acquisitions and different assets in different regions of the country for opportunities. And so when something hits the transom, if it's a deal in New Jersey, or if it's a deal in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, or it's a deal in Portsmouth, Virginia, or Dayton, Ohio, those are all markets where we've been able to deploy capital. And so we tend to not buy assets in 24-hour cities or coastal expensive markets, and that's not because there's not deals to do there, but, you know, they tend to be, more expensive markets just by nature, and a lot of real estate sponsors tend to look in those locations. So if you looked at where we've bought assets over time, it's, you know, Missouri, Texas, Ohio, and there's really not as much here recently, as much geographic concentration or property type concentration. We're really willing to look across asset type and across geography.
So what scares you most about the future of the strategy you're using? I mean, what keeps you up at night? What could you see going wrong with the current strategy you're pursuing? There must be an Achilles heel somewhere.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, every strategy, you know, has headwinds. But, you know, I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges that we face is just the overall, you know, perception and just the reality that the real estate market hasn't had, you know, we're in the later innings of the cycle, in our opinion, and, you know, we feel that, you know, if we continue to have a favorable interest rate environment and rates don't spike too quickly, that the cycle could continue, you know, and some people called it early, right? You know, we exited multifamily probably end of last year, and multifamily continues to chug right along. So, I'd say one potential headwind is just the overall as we seek to grow the business, you know, one of the challenges will be, you know, how do you get thoughtful investors to, you know, to take notice and stop and take a look at what you're trying to do and the message you're trying to deliver when things do seem to be going so well. I think the other thing is you've got to constantly help investors understand where does a opportunistic distressed workout strategy fit into an investor's portfolio. Many of the investors that we talk to, you know, they say, look, we have kind of a full allocation to real estate at this point, and if we're doing anything, we're doing it very, very selectively and tactically. And so that was not the case in, you know, 2010 and 11 when folks were, you know, they didn't have a full up real estate allocation. So, you know, it's a competition for dollars when you're trying to grow your business. And that means typically in this later innings of the cycle, you have to displace someone who's an incumbent. And, you know, the fund business is a re-up business. So as a new sponsor that's, you know, relatively new in the last 7-8 years, You're having to establish relationships, and you're having to establish, you know, trust and credibility, and those are all things that we've been working real hard at. But and then, you know, I'd say from just an overall, just an income-oriented perspective, because one of the features of our one of the funds that's open now is that, you know, we do look to return capital to investors. As I mentioned, the strategy is a 12 to kind of 24 month. Hold period for assets, and so we want to return investors capital more rapidly than a traditional private real estate fund vehicle that's kind of set up for an 8 to 10 year, maybe 12 year hold period. And so in doing so, you know, you are with many investors seeking income and seeking yield and seeking to get capital back and recycle it, you are facing just a great deal of competition. You know, there's a lot of real estate debt strategies in the market that are seeking to raise money. And then there's, you know, there's lots and lots of other opportunities for investors to put capital to work in direct lending and other things. So the competition for capital is also, you know, just because of the income seeking nature of many investors as they look to, you know, reduce the allocation to fixed income or seek some yield in their portfolio, it does, you know, bring a lot more participants to the market to try to deliver that solution.
Well, so far, so good. And, you know, you mentioned that you're seeing good opportunities in Europe, and you dropped a note to me today. This is, in fact, we leave this Sunday for a week in Spain to see assets, a troubled country these days with separatist movements and all, but trouble seems to be your middle name, Andre. So I wish you luck with that trip and the overall strategy, and really appreciate you taking the time to walk us through this. It's an interesting strategy, and as you said at the conference, it's not the sexiest strategy, but it has been very dependable.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we set out to do when we built the business, Mike, was we wanted to be able to deliver investors, you know, superior long-term, you know, tax-efficient absolute returns. And we wanted to, you know, bring down volatility and try to have lower correlations to the broader equity markets. And we felt that, you know, there was really a seminal point in 2015 where, you know, we as an organization had to make a decision. Was the distress cycle that got us started going to kind of, was that going to be the end, if you will, or were we going to continue to try to find inefficiencies and opportunities? What we found is that this, you know, defaulted mortgage market, this non-performing loan market, we kind of say to investors, you know, so long as there are banks making loans, you know, there's never going to be a 100%, you know, they're never going to be 100% right. And so there's always going to be opportunity. And you know, that's going to increase in terms of volume of distress in markets coming off of where we're at today. The volumes are going to be a little bit lower when we're in a kind of a peaking market. So long as loans are made, there's going to be bad mortgages, and that's going to create opportunities for groups like us. So we're going to, you know, stick to the focus and continue to try to execute for our investors.
Andre, thank you again, and good luck.
Thanks, Mike.